is something that disproportionately targets older New Yorkers. They tend to be black and brown New Yorkers, where an individual will knock on the door of one of those same New Yorkers and say, do you need assistance in resolving your inheritance or refinancing your home, preying upon their desire to actually pass that home on to their next generation or to ensure that they can stay in that home. And there are so many of those New Yorkers who have then lost the title to their own home through this kind of being preyed upon. And so our office would take advantage of the new state rules that have allowed the city greater enforcement authority on this issue, would also fund for about $20 million lawyers and further legal assistance for New Yorkers who would then be proactively reached out to by the city of New York, and would look at the example of a tangled title fund in Pennsylvania and bring the success of that here so that the city is assisting New Yorkers in ensuring that their next generation can inherit their home, as opposed to leaving them to the prey of someone who would look to actually engage in deed theft.
Well, let's talk, Zoran, about issues that, of course, are very relevant to people in New York, but the principal action is happening elsewhere, and what you've commented on many times, namely what's unfolding in Gaza. Right now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was just here in New York, scheduled to meet Trump on Monday. So if you could talk about what you've heard from New Yorkers on this issue.
You know, I can tell you, I have heard from New Yorkers across the five boroughs a real sense of despair and horror at the genocide that we've seen in Gaza, and an understanding of complicity as Americans in the funding of this genocide. And New Yorkers are looking for someone to be their mayor who will focus on this city, who will deliver for the people of this city, and someone who also, amidst all of that, has the moral clarity to have a politics of consistency. And that's what has been at the heart of our campaign, a consistent belief in the universality of ideals like humanity, like justice, like safety, and the ways in which Benjamin Netanyahu's genocide of Palestinians is a violation not only of those ideals, but also of international law. And we've seen that in the issuing of a warrant for his arrest by the International Criminal Court.
I wanted to go to a journalist questioning Netanyahu at a White House dinner hosted by Donald Trump in July.
Israel, I know yourself, and has said he would arrest you if you came to New York City if he was mayor. Is that something you take seriously? Are you concerned about that? Do you have a response to that?
No, I'm not concerned about that. Oh, well, look, I'm going to come there with the President Trump, and we'll see how do you know who the mayor will be? I don't know that. Do we know that?
He's going to be very fine, and who knows? We don't know who the mayor's going to be yet, but this is a communist. He's not a socialist. He's a communist, and he said some really bad things about Jewish people, and he said some really bad things about a lot of people. And I think he's going through a little bit of a honeymoon right now, but he might make it. But, you know, it all comes through the White House. He needs the money through the White House. He needs a lot. He's going to behave. He'll behave. He better behave. Otherwise, he's going to have big problems.
So if you can respond to both President Trump and Netanyahu, Trump has been going after you since you announced. He talked about detaining you, checking whether he might be able to deport you, talking about you as a communist. You, in exchange, talk about Trump-proofing New York.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it is a sad reality in this country where we have a president who ran an entire campaign premised on cheaper groceries and lowering the cost of living. And what he has instead delivered time and again is an exacerbating of that very crisis, all while focusing on the persecution of his supposed political enemies. And when we talk about Trump-proofing the city, it's not just the question of hiring the 200 additional lawyers at our law department to bring us back to the staffing levels prior to the pandemic. It's a question of actually standing up and fighting Donald Trump. And fighting Donald Trump because what his agenda is doing is endangering the welfare of New Yorkers. This bill that he recently ushered through Washington, D.C., it throws millions of New Yorkers off of their health care. It steals SNAP benefits from so many hungry New Yorkers. And it does all of this in the interests of the largest wealth transfer that we've seen in this country. And to do those things while speaking about a cost of living crisis, it is truly a betrayal of so much of what his campaign was premised on, and an illustration of why he is so fearful of our campaign. Because unlike him, we don't just diagnose this crisis. We will deliver on it. We will actually ensure that we have New Yorkers who can afford the city that they call home, that we freeze the rent for more than 2 million New Yorkers, we make buses fast and free, which are currently the slowest ones in the nation, and we deliver universal child care. And that's what Donald Trump is afraid of, the stark contrast between our delivery of those things and what he has done as the president of this country.
So, Ron Mamdani, what does it mean to be a democratic socialist?
You know, I think of the words of Dr. King from decades ago, who said, call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, there must be a better distribution of wealth for all of God's children in this country. And New Yorkers understand that. We're in the wealthiest city in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, and one in four New Yorkers are living in poverty. When I walked into this interview, I walked past a New Yorker who was sleeping on the street. That's the level of poverty in this city, and yet it's happening amidst great wealth. And the vision for this city has to be one that understands the dignity of working people must return to the heart of our politics, and to focus on that is to fulfill the ideals that brought so many to politics in the first place, and the abandonment of it has been what's pushed so many away from it.
So, Zohran, let's talk about some of the support that you've received that was perhaps almost unprecedented, and in this case, unprecedented. Over the weekend, you received an endorsement from Bend the Arc Jewish Action, the very first time the organization has endorsed anyone in a mayoral race. In their endorsement, they wrote, "We are really very excited about Zohran and his platform, not in spite of our commitment to Jewish values, but because of them." So if you could talk about this endorsement.
You know, I am honored to have the endorsement of Bend the Arc and to be the first municipal candidate to receive it. It really is a privilege. And it showcases the fact that this coalition that we have, it is a coalition that not only continues to expand, but also looks to reflect the beauty and the breadth of this city. And one of the many things that makes this city so special are the close to 1 million Jewish residents of this city. And I take very seriously my responsibility and my opportunity to not only protect Jewish New Yorkers, but to celebrate so much of what they have brought the city and so much of what it means to be a city with such a thriving community. And I think of this period of the High Holy Days as one where our politics and our politicians would do well to learn from the lessons of these very holidays that seek to impart a reflection on what the prior year has been, an atonement, and a real level of humility as to what it means to lead. And that is the kind of lessons that I hope to learn in delivering leadership to this city.
I was getting messages from congregants at Rosh Hashanah when you went to a synagogue then, and also hearing about the reports of a woman handing you stickers she'd made with a picture of bagels and lox and a message urging Jewish voters to support Mr. Mamdani. And on the stickers, it said, "Reject the smear campaign, join the schmear campaign."
Yes, this is very creative, and I think it's a reflection that for all of the fear-mongering that we've seen in this race, part of the reason that I sit before you as the Democratic nominee is because of the support of so many Jewish New Yorkers of all generations. And I'm so excited by that support and the prospect of building that support by reaching out to Jewish New Yorkers across the five boroughs, including at their synagogues.
And finally, Zohran, we know you have to go, but you know many people have talked about the fact that you mobilized so much of the youth vote. But you also mobilized a lot of the South Asian vote, many people voting for the first time in a mayoral election, and Muslim communities as well. You'll be, if you win, the first Muslim mayor of New York, the first South Asian mayor. So if you could say, you know, how important was that support to you? And explain your decision, in fact, to emphasize the fact that you're both a Muslim, South Asian, and in fact also African.
You know, these are parts of my identity. They are parts of what has formed me and my life over the course of both being a New Yorker and even before that. And I think it's a desire at the heart of our politics to ensure that these electoral outcomes, these contests that we have, that they actually reflect the city at large. Too often, New York City politics is focused on an ever-narrowing group of New Yorkers, the ones who vote every primary. And yet we know that there are so many New Yorkers who call the city home just in the manner of those voters, but are not spoken to with the same respect, are not given the same kind of time. And from the beginning of this race, we said we wanted this race to look like the entire city. And that means speaking to the very South Asian and Muslim New Yorkers that too often have been looked at as, at best, there to be for a photo op, as opposed to New Yorkers who are also suffering from this affordability crisis.
So, Ron Mamdani, we are broadcasting this on Monday. We spoke to you on Sunday, right after Adams said he's pulling out of the election campaign. We also spoke to you the day after he was indicted on corruption charges. Of course, Trump would dismiss those charges later. But I also wanted to ask you, on this day, Monday, that we broadcast this, apparently the Democratic leaders will be at the White House, Hakeem Jeffries, a minority leader Chuck Schumer, meeting with Trump over the whole issue of the budget and whether the country is going to be shut down. I want to know which is more contentious, that meeting, Trump, Schumer, and Hakeem Jeffries, or their meetings, Hakeem Jeffries and Schumer, with you. I was just watching Senator Van Hollen, who is really castigating his fellow Democrats who had not yet supported you. Many have, from corporate Democrats, conservative Democrats, on to progressives. But talk about that. Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer not having supported you yet, even though you are the Democratic primary candidate. And what is being said in these meetings? They keep saying they're talking to you.
Yes, we have had a number of meetings, and I've appreciated the meetings because the focus of the meetings has been on the fact that New Yorkers are facing twin crises, authoritarianism from Washington, D.C., and an affordability crisis from the inside. And we often tend to separate these out. We think about democracy as an ideal that must be protected, but not that democracy also has to be able to deliver on the material needs of working people. And it was Fiorella LaGuardia that said, you cannot preach liberty to a starving land. You have to be able to deliver on both fronts. And to me, in these meetings, the focus has been how to do so. And I would say that the meeting that they will have with Donald Trump is going to be far more contentious than the ones that we've had. Ours have been focused on New Yorkers. Donald Trump is focused on himself and his donors. And it is time to showcase the cost of the legislation that he has ushered through, what it would mean for New Yorkers' lives. I mean, I was at a hospital in the Bronx just a few days ago, speaking to 1199 members who were telling me that these cuts, they could decimate their ability to take care of New Yorkers in their toughest moments and in their best moments. And yet that is the agenda that Donald Trump is pursuing. And I continue to be hopeful and to be focused on the necessity of turning back that legislation, ensuring those cuts do not come to pass in the manner that they have been written.
We're going to end where we intended to begin today, before Eric Adams announced that he's dropping out, which became top news. And that is by you saying your name. Of course, your main opponent, Andrew Cuomo, continually mispronounces your name. I want you to respond to that. This is how he does it.
I'm running against a man named Zoran Mamdani. Mm-hmm. He's a socialist.
If you can respond to that and tell us how you say it, your full name.
Zoran Kwame Mamdani. And I think what has been offensive to me is not whether a New Yorker can say my name on their first attempt or their second, but that what Andrew Cuomo has done is to deliberately mispronounce that name. And it is something whose meaning is not just about me. It's about how so many New Yorkers have to deal with this in their own workplace, in their own lives. You know, I was at a mosque recently for Friday prayers, and I asked the uncles and the aunties there to raise their hands if they've ever had to deal with the basic indignity of having the name that they were given be butchered time and again with an intention of belittling them. And hand after hand after hand raised. And that shows me the ways in which so many have been overlooked, at the very least. And our campaign, it's not a campaign to ensure that everyone can say my name. It's a campaign to ensure that each and every New Yorker is celebrated for the fullest version of themselves, who they actually are, and belonging to the fabric of this gorgeous mosaic, as David Dinkins once called it.
And your middle name, Kwame, where it comes from?
I was named by my father after Kwame Nkrumah, the first prime minister of Ghana. And it is a point of pride for me and a reflection of the fact that I would also be the first immigrant mayor of the city in generations. I was born in Kampala, Uganda, in East Africa, moved here when I was 7. It's the city where I grew up, the city where I met my wife, the city where I got my citizenship, and hopefully the city I will lead.
Leading New York City mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani, speaking with us Sunday, just after Mayor Eric Adams dropped out of the mayoral race. When we come back, thousands protest in New York as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addresses the United Nations, and then Assata Shakur in her own words. Stay with us.
Nebedi fantame jigideng ene na ha ala ham faso ba ta soman lada ie nebe.
Unite by Fatoumata Jawara, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now! On Friday, we were in the streets outside the United Nations. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Inside the United Nations today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave his address to the UN General Assembly. This is a part of what he said.
The final elements, the final remnants of Hamas are holed up in Gaza City. They vow to repeat the atrocities of October 7th again and again and again, no matter how diminished their forces. That is why Israel must finish the job. That is why we want to do so as fast as possible.
As Netanyahu spoke, scores of delegates walked out of the UN General Assembly. This week, Western countries like Britain and Australia, France, Portugal, Canada, Belgium, and others joined more than 150 other countries in recognizing the state of Palestine. That leaves only the United States on the UN Security Council not to have recognized Palestine. Outside the UN today, thousands protested Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Up, up with liberation!
Up, up with liberation!
Down, down with occupation!
I'm Nazi Issa. I'm with the Palestinian Youth Movement, and we're here to demand the arrest of Netanyahu, the wanted war criminal, and to demand an arms embargo on Israel for its genocide against Palestinians. Well, you know, he's not going to come to the UN without meeting the resistance of this city. You know, and we're seeing, you know, that now we even have a mayoral candidate who's saying that if he's elected mayor, he won't allow Netanyahu to set foot in this city without arresting him. And so we're seeing the growing international isolation of Netanyahu, his bloc, and Israel, and that's what we're here to solidify. Symbolic rejection of Netanyahu isn't enough. Turning their backs on Netanyahu isn't enough. They need to take action as member states of the United Nations and impose real sanctions, an arms embargo, and a trade embargo on Israel.
My name is Reed Brody. I'm an international war crimes prosecutor. Benjamin Netanyahu has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, crimes against humanity, for using starvation as a weapon of war. He is a fugitive from justice. States that are parties to the ICC have a duty to arrest him, and even states like the United States, which aren't parties, have a duty to arrest a war criminal. The United States is complicit in the war crimes being committed in Israel. The bombs that are being used to destroy Palestinian homes and schools and houses are American bombs. The campaign of extermination that Israel is carrying out is being done with American political support. The United States should be arresting him, not faking him.
My name is Nida Alafi. I'm a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, and I'm here with the thousands of people to say, you know, Netanyahu should not be at the UNGA. Actually, he should be tried for his crimes at The Hague. And, you know, we're all here the same way we have been for the past 2 years, demanding that governments and leaders take real action to end the genocide that has only escalated, right? For it to have reached this level of atrocities and for him to still have a spot at the UNGA is absolutely egregious. And that's why I think now more than ever, people are more agitated. People are more angry. I mean, we see in Italy, you know, millions of people have gone on strike, right? And here the streets are filled with thousands of people when Netanyahu's room, when he was speaking to the UNGA, was mostly empty.
My name is Lita Hirschman Levy, and I'm a member of Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm disgusted that our country would allow this war criminal here. There is no reason for him to be here. He should be locked up. He should not have any power as far as I'm concerned. He is a war criminal. He is perpetuating and creating a genocide in Gaza. He is murdering thousands of Palestinians. This is is not in the name of Jewish safety. It is goes against everything that Judaism stands for. I'm horrified that this is happening in my name as a Jewish person. I'm the descendant of Holocaust survivors. My grandparents were Holocaust survivors. He is not welcome here. He is a war criminal, and this has to end. Palestine needs to be free, liberated, with the right to return home.
Voices from the streets as thousands marched to the United Nations demanding the arrest of the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and an end to Israel's war on Gaza. Special thanks to Jenny Keenan and Safwat Mazal. Inside the UN, more than 100 diplomats from over 50 countries walked out in protest during Netanyahu's remarks at the General Assembly. Meanwhile, outside the UN, Colombian President Gustavo Petro joined protesters Friday, calling for an international intervention to end Israel's genocide. He also urged U.S. troops to disobey orders from President Trump.
The global force has to be bigger than that of the United States. That's why from here, from New York, I ask all of the soldiers of the Army of the U.S. not to point their guns at people. Disobey the orders of Trump. Obey the orders of humanity.
The Trump administration said Friday it had revoked President Petro's visa for joining the pro-Palestinian protest outside the UN. In response, Petro wrote online, quote, revoking it for denouncing genocide shows the U.S. no longer respects international law, unquote. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the words of Assata Shakur, who died in Havana, Cuba, Thursday at the age of 78. She was a legendary figure within the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army. Assata Shakur was convicted in the May 2, 1973 killing of a New Jersey state trooper during a shootout that left one of her fellow activists dead. She was shot twice by police during the incident. In 1979, she managed to escape from jail and flee to Cuba, where she received political asylum. She long proclaimed her innocence. In 1998, Democracy Now! Aired her reading an open letter to Pope John Paul II during his trip to Cuba. She wrote the message after New Jersey state troopers sent the Pope a letter asking him to call for her extradition. This is Assata Shakur.
My name is Assata Shakur, and I was born and raised in the United States. I am a descendant of Africans who were kidnapped and brought to the Americas as slaves. I spent my early childhood in the racist, segregated South. I later moved to the northern part of the country, where I realized that Black people were equally victimized by racism and oppression. I grew up and became a political activist, participating in student struggles, the anti-war movement, and most of all, in the movement for the liberation of African Americans in the United States. I later joined the Black Panther Party, an organization that was targeted by the COINTELPRO program, a program that was set up by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to eliminate all political opposition to the U.S. government's policies, to destroy the Black liberation movement in the United States, to discredit activists, and to eliminate potential leaders. Under the COINTELPRO program, many political activists were harassed, imprisoned, murdered, or otherwise neutralized. As a result of being targeted by COINTELPRO, I, like many other young people, was faced with the threat of prison, underground, exile, or death. The FBI, with the help of local police agencies, systematically fed false accusations and fake news articles to the press, accusing me and other activists of crimes we did not commit. Although in my case, the charges were eventually dropped, or I was eventually acquitted, the national and local police agencies created a situation where, based on their false accusations against me, any police officer could shoot me on sight. It was not until the Freedom of Information Act was passed in the mid-70s that we began to see the scope of the United States government's persecution of political activists. At this point, I think that it is important to make one thing very clear. I have advocated, and I still advocate, revolutionary changes in the structure and in the principles that govern the United States. I advocate self-determination for my people and for all oppressed people inside the United States. I advocate an end to capitalist exploitation, the abolition of racist policies, the eradication of sexism, and the elimination of political repression. If that is a crime, then I am totally guilty. To make a long story short, I was captured in New Jersey in 1973 after being shot with both arms held in the air and then shot again from the back. I was left on the ground to die, and when I did not, I was taken to a local hospital where I was threatened, beaten, and tortured. In 1977, I was convicted in a trial that can only be described as a legal lynching. In 1979, I was able to escape with the aid of some of my fellow comrades. I saw this as a necessary step, not only because I was innocent of the charges against me, but because I knew that the racist legal system in the United States, I would receive no justice. I was also afraid that I would be murdered in prison. I later arrived in Cuba, where I am currently living in exile as a political refugee. The New Jersey State Police and other law enforcement officials say they want to see me brought to justice. But I would like to know what they mean by justice. Is torture justice? I was kept in solitary confinement for more than 2 years, mostly in men's prisons. Is that justice? My lawyers were threatened with imprisonment and imprisoned. Is that justice? I was tried by an all-white jury without even the pretext of impartiality and then sentenced to life in prison plus 33 years. Is that justice? Let me emphasize that justice for me is not the issue I am addressing here. It is justice for my people that is at stake. When my people receive justice, I am sure that I will receive it too. I ask nothing for myself. I only ask you to examine the social reality of the United States and to speak out against the human rights violations that are taking place. On this day, the birthday of Martin Luther King, I am reminded of all those who gave their lives for freedom. Most of the people who live on this planet are still not free. I ask only that you continue to work and pray to end oppression and political repression. It is my heartfelt belief that all the people on this earth deserve justice, social justice, political justice, and economic justice. I believe it is the only way we will ever achieve peace and prosperity on this earth. I hope that you enjoy your visit to Cuba. This is not a country that is rich in material wealth, but it is a country that is rich in human wealth, spiritual wealth, and moral wealth. Respectfully yours, Asada Shakur, Havana, Cuba.
That was Asada Shakur reading an open letter to the Pope in 1998. The Black liberation activist died on Thursday at the age of 78 in Cuba, where she had political asylum. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Paul Powell. This coming weekend, I'll be speaking Saturday, October 4th, at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco, doing a Q&A after the Jewish Film Institute's special documentary screening of Steal the Story, Please, a new documentary about Democracy Now! Sunday, October 5th, I'll be in Berkeley at BAMFA for a screening of the documentary, again with the Oscar-nominated directors Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl. On Friday, October 17th, I'll be in Santa Fe at the Lensic Theater, and October 18th and 19th at the Woodstock Film Festival. Go to democracynow.org for details. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.